Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to Joshua chapter 9. Verse number 16 will allow us to get part of the context, Beck, from where we stopped off yesterday. Remember that the Israelis were visited at Gilgal by a delegation that claimed that they were from far away and that they wanted to make an alliance with the Israelis because they'd heard all about He Who Is, all about Yahweh. And they were impressed about everything they'd heard about Him. The Israelis were a little bit suspicious, asked them about where it was they actually lived and how they could be sure that they weren't Canaanites from nearby. And these guys lied to them. And they'd already prepared to lie to them, showed them their provisions and their own clothing, and said, see, look at this stuff. This is all brand new and fresh when we left, and it's all worn out now. That's how long it took us to get here. The Israelis did not check in with God about it. And so Joshua and the leadership go ahead and swear an oath of allegiance, or alliance, I should say, with these people from Gibeon. Now, Gibeon is actually only about 10 miles or so south and west of the crossroads of Bethel and Ai, which the Israelis control. Once they've got the oath that's been made in the name of God, the Gibeonites go back home. And the story picks up in Joshua 9:16. At the end of 3 days after they'd made a covenant with them, they heard that they were their neighbors and that they lived among them. Joshua's probably got spies out checking the areas around the regions which are under their control, which, by the way, let's talk about that again. The plains of Jericho, that's under Israeli control. The wadi that go up from the plains of Jericho, that is the wet weather stream, the gully road that goes up from Jericho to Ai and Bethel, that's under Israeli control. And then the central ridgeline highway that goes north from right around Bethel and Ai, about 10 or 12 miles north to Shechem. That's under Israeli control as well. So Gibeon is on the fringe of a region that's already under Israeli control, and Joshua is probably constantly checking on the communities just outside of that area control. And they find out the Gibeonites actually are in Canaan. So verse 17, the people of Israel set out and they reached their cities on the third day. So they found out on one day, made the march at least part of the way the next day, and then actually made contact on the third day. And that makes good sense if you're coming from Gilgal, down by Jericho. Now their cities were Gibeon, Kephira, Beeroth, and Kiriath-Yearim. But the people of Israel did not attack them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by He Who Is, the God of Israel. And then all the congregation murmured against the leaders. They're upset because they are now seeing themselves in violation of God's command to either run out the Canaanites from their territory or execute them if they try to stay. But they can't do that with the Gibeonites because the leadership, without checking in with God, swore to them an alliance and protection. And the common Israelis are probably a little bit concerned that that's going to come back and bite them. Verse number 19, but all the leaders said to all the congregations, We have sworn to them by He who is the God of Israel, and now we may not touch them. So we can't execute them. Forget that. That's not going to happen. We can't run them out of their towns. We made promises. Verse 20, but this we will do to them. Let them live, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath that we swore to them. Because once they swore it in the name of He who is, they can't go back on it, or God Himself is insulted. Verse 21, the leaders said to them, let them live. So they became cutters of wood and drawers of water for all the congregation, just as the leaders had said to them. So the Israelis go through a lot of wood and water for the tabernacle in particular. And Israelis have been having to do that up to this point. So the leaders of Israel say, look, this is what we'll do. We can't kill them. We can't run them out because we made promises in the name of God. But we can put them into a job that will benefit you guys. We'll have them cut the wood and haul the wood for the tabernacle, and we'll make them the guys that have to make sure the water is constantly being supplied for the tabernacle's high usage. So verse 22, Joshua summoned them, that is the Gibeonites, and he said to them, why did you deceive us, saying, we are very far from you when you dwell among us? Now, therefore, you are cursed, and some of you shall never be anything but servants, cutters of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. They answered Joshua, because it was told to your servants for a certainty that He who is your God had commanded His servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. So we feared greatly for our lives because of you and did this thing. And now, behold, we are in your hand. Whatever seems good and right in your sight to do to us, do it. So he did this to them and delivered them out of the hand of the people of Israel and did not kill them. But Joshua made them cutters of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of He who is to this day in the place that he should choose. So the Gibeonites express the beginnings of faith in the one true God and a desire to basically be folded into Israel, even if it is as slaves. And they actually do become an integral part of the worship site that will eventually be located near their town of Gibeon. The tabernacle will eventually relocate right next to Gibeon after it's destroyed at Shiloh. And these guys, even through those years, will be supplying the wood and the water for it, wherever it's at. And this is an interesting parallel to what happened with Rahab and her family, because they showed some basic faith in the one true God, that He really meant what He said to the Israelis. They end up being spared and folded into the Israeli nation and become a very important part of it. Rahab, in fact, even becomes part of the family tree of King David, and therefore of the Messiah. All right, so probably all of that happened over the winter of 1416 into 1415. And then we come to the fighting season, the springtime, I believe, of 1415, which is going to be then the second year that they're in the land, and the 42nd year of the Exodus. Chapter number 10 of Joshua. As soon as Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had captured Ai and had devoted it to destruction, doing to Ai and its king as he'd done to Jericho and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them, he feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were warriors. All right, so let's kind of chew our way through bits of information here. Gibeon is apparently a more significant and more powerful city than Ai had been. And Ai was taken by the Israelis without too much trouble. And so Gibeon just surrenders to the Israelis. The king of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is just a little bit south and east of Gibeon. Jerusalem is, 15, 20 miles south of Bethlehem Ai. So we're talking about a very close region here in the central portion of the country of the Canaanites. So the city of Jerusalem, probably at this time, it's known as Salem, or maybe Jebus. They hear that the Israelis have control of even closer regions to their area. And it bothers the guy that's in charge. He goes by the name of Adoni Zedek, which is interesting in the Hebrew. Because the last king of Jerusalem that we met was back in the book of Genesis. The guy that Abraham interacted with. And his name in Hebrew was Melchizedek. And Melchi means king. Zedek means righteousness. So the king of righteousness. This guy's name is Adoni Zedek. Adoni means lord or master. It is synonymous with the term king. So he is the lord or master of righteousness. And more than likely, Adoni Zedek is either the physical descendant of Melchizedek from 500 or 600 years earlier, or he is the political descendant of that character that Abraham interacted with. But things have deteriorated considerably, because you remember the original Melchizedek was priest of God Most High. He actually served the true and living God. That is all gone now. Jerusalem is the site of pagan religion. And so the king of Jerusalem, Adoni Bezek, he is concerned that this Israeli thing is getting way out of hand, and that the Gibeonites have now just surrendered to them, and he needs to take charge. Obviously, they're not going to get any help from the Egyptians, even though lots of correspondence has gone that direction, and we can see that correspondence in the Tel Amarna letters. He decides to get up a local alliance to attack the Gibeonites, to basically stop this region from coming under the full control of the Israelis. Verse number 3. So Adoni Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoham, king of Hebron. Now that's where Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are all buried, along with their wives. So it's a special place for the Israelis. It's south of Jerusalem. To Piram, king of Yarmuth, to Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon. So these are all places to the south, and some of them off to the west of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is under the most direct threat from the Israelis because they're closest to his borders. But he calls up his southern neighbors and says, you guys have got to help me to fight against the Israelis. And the best thing we can do is keep Gibeon, the city, the royal city, the stronghold, from coming under their direct control. Verse 4, come up to me and help me. Let us strike Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the people of Israel. Then the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Yarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered their forces and went up with all their armies and camped against Gibeon and made war against it. So their goal is, we will take out these locals, these fellow Canaanites that have effectively made a peace treaty with the Israelis. We'll take them, kill them, and put our own troops, our own forces into this stronghold, and that will stop the Israelis from coming any closer to our direction. It'll give us a better chance of at least protecting the southern part of Canaan against this invasion. Well, the Gibeonites, they see the attacking armies besieging them, and they invoke the peace treaty, because this treaty would have included protection from the Israelis. So verse number 6, the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp of Gilgal, saying, do not relax your hand from your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the hill country are gathered against us. So help, come and rescue us. Verse 7. So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. And evidently he checks in with God before he does this, because God responds in this fashion. Verse number 8. He who is said to Joshua, do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not a man of them shall stand before you. So Joshua is told by God, you have nothing to fear from this five-city army. So Joshua came upon them suddenly, having marched up all night from Gilgal. Now you might remember the last time we heard about movement, they came to Gibeon on the third day after they found something out. So they went, they traveled the middle day, and then they arrived probably early on the third day. This time, they're under a forced march. They are moving all night as fast as they can with their arms in order to arrive first thing the next morning. But God is fighting for them. Verse 10, he who is through them, meaning the Amorites, the Canaanite people, into a panic before Israel, who struck them with a great blow at Gibeon. Now, Gibeon, as I told you, it's a little bit south and west of Bethel Ai. And so it is the closest in of these cities to the Israeli area. So it's the first place that gets attacked. And so the Israelis rout the Amorite forces because God puts a panic into them. And then they chase them by the way of the ascent of Beth Horon. So Beth Horon is the next city down the road from Gibeon heading toward the Mediterranean. Beth Horon is just a few miles north and west of Gibeon. So they're basically chasing them downhill toward the coastline, toward the Mediterranean plain. And then we next read, that they struck them as far as Azekka and Makeda. Now, this is quite a little ways away from this original battle that we're talking about here. Azekka actually is a city that overlooks the Valley of Elah, where the fight between David and Goliath takes place. And that's quite a few miles to the southwest of where we're talking about now. But effectively what's going to happen is the Israelis are going to chase them west for a while till they get down on the level plain, and then they're going to chase them south. And the last bit of chasing takes place down by the Valley of Elah. That's where the other side hides in cities and in caves to escape the pursuing Israeli forces. Verse number 11, "And as they fled before Israel, while they were going down the ascent of Beth Horon," so they're heading down the hill westward, away from Gibeon, "he who is throw down large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekka, and they died." So the retreating forces of these Amorites, they are pelted by hailstones from God the entire time they are in retreat, heading first west and then heading south. And the text, the inspired word of God, says there were more who died because of the hailstones than the sons of Israel killed with the sword. So God's artillery is doing more damage than what the Israelis themselves are doing. And the miracle of the hailstorm is this: the Israelis are not affected by it. This is a very localized hailstorm. It stays over the top of the retreating Amorite forces, not over the Israelis, and follows them first westward, which is against the normal direction that weather comes against across Israel, and then it goes southward along the road. And so all those casualties are laying along the way. Now, before they leave the valley area that goes from Gibeon past Beth Horon and down toward the Mediterranean plain, so right at the beginning of the route, right at the beginning of their retreat, this is what happens. Verse 12, "At that time Joshua spoke to he who is in the day when he who is gave the Amorites over to the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, sun stand still at Gibeon." So the sun was apparently up and over Gibeon, that is, at the peak of the sky, whenever this fight started and the Amorites started retreating. "And moon in the valley of Aijalon." Aijalon is to the west of Gibeon. So the moon must have been on the horizon in front of them as they're chasing these guys to the west, which means that we're coming toward the end of a month, because that's the configuration for the moon being in that position to the sun. Verse 13, "And the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Yashar?" Yashar has to do with the upright, and it's got something to do with a historical record that the Israelis kept. "The sun stopped in the midst of heaven and did not hurry to set for about a whole day." Now, it's a little vague what's meant by that. Other than this, it would appear that God gave them an extended period of time to chase these retreating Amorites westward down toward the Mediterranean and then southward down toward Azekka. So he gave them longer than 6 hours, which would be, you know, if the sun is above you and 6 hours later it's going to be going down. He gave them longer than 6 hours to chase these guys down on that particular day. Verse 14, there's been no day like it before or since when he who is obeyed the voice of a man, for he who is fought for Israel. So this is the long day of Joshua. And I am very much a supernaturalist. I believe that this is literally what happened. God gave a longer than normal day. And it's not any big deal for God to stop the rotation of the earth. It's not going to be any type of inertia problems, because God would take that in consideration. If he can stop the earth from rotating, he can stop the effects of inertia. But he can also do something simple like bending the light rays around the earth and giving longer daylight to the Israelis through refraction, which certainly can happen under certain conditions. So however God did it, he miraculously gave the Israelis more time. And verse number 15, it kind of jumps ahead of the story. So Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal. That's what will happen at the very end. Tomorrow, we'll have to delve more into this next part of the story. It says, these five kings fled and hid themselves in the cave at Makkedah. That's at the end of the running away part of this day. Somewhere down near Azekah is this Makkedah cave. And it was told to Joshua, the five kings have been found. They're hidden in the caves of Makkedah. And Joshua said, roll large stones against the mouth of the cave and set men to guard it. But don't stay there yourselves. Pursue the enemy. Attack their rear guard. So Joshua basically says, okay, good report. I'm glad you got him there. Pin him in by putting a big rock in the place. But let's get everybody we can during this day of battle. And then we'll come back and deal with these trapped kings.